Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. In large Utah Supreme Court, long overdue in a growing state, or a blatant partisan power ploy by GOP legislature. How many Utahns have been arrested by ICE under President Trump's second term? Here's the data. And this Utah charter school is under review after it gave little oversight to its bookkeeper, allowing years of payroll errors. Today on the program, we're joined by Salt Lake Tribune politics reporter Robert Gerke. Robert, thanks for joining us.
Hey, good morning, Tom.
Good morning. Westside Communities reporter Jose Davila IV is with us as well. Jose, thank you.
Thanks for having me, Tom. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. And education reporter Carmen Nesbitt is with us. Carmen, thank you.
Hi, Tom. Of course.
You bet. Happy New Year to you, to all of you. Let's start with Robert. So let's start with the Supreme Court. Here's the headline. In large Utah Supreme Court, long overdue in a growing state, are a blatant partisan power ploy by the GOP legislature. Do we have official word they're going to at least have this during the 45-day legislative session?
Yeah, the anticipation is that somebody will sponsor a bill. It sounds like it's probably going to be Senator Wilson from up in your neck of the woods. And this is kind of interesting. A lot of people think, well, doesn't this have to be done in the with a constitutional amendment? No, the Constitution just says the legislature sets the number of justices on the court. So they can adjust it from 5 to 7 with just a bill. The governor's included it in his budget proposal that came out in December. The budgetary impact's about $2.8 million. That's for 2 additional Supreme Court justices and 2 appellate court justices and their staff and their, you know, their salaries. And then there's about a $1.7 million cost of actually expanding, like providing office space and computers and things like that for them, the one-time costs that would be associated with that. But this has a lot of support from Republican leadership, particularly we heard last session Speaker Schultz pushing for it. Governor Cox is now on board with it, and so it's got a lot of momentum.
So this with Utah Supreme Court, we go from 5 members to 7. In your story, you looked at some other states who somewhat recently have expanded their Supreme Court. So what happened there?
Yeah, this doesn't necessarily happen a whole lot, but there were 2 states, I believe, in 2016 that did an expansion. One of them, just our neighbor to the south, Arizona, and then one of them, Georgia. And it was kind of interesting. I thought that when Arizona expanded, they actually were able to issue fewer rulings than they had in the past. So it didn't necessarily accelerate their ability to handle cases. The other thing that's kind of interesting is the context of both of those were, Republican majorities adding justices to their court to change the balance of power on that bench, you know, make it from Democrat to Republican. And so, in those instances, clearly it was a political move. The governor and some of the legislators say that's not, they don't see it as a political move. They're concerned about the number of opinions that the Supreme Court here in Utah has been able to get through on an annual basis.
So the governor and legislators are saying, no, not a political move. There are others in the state who are saying they feel like this is a political move.
Yeah, Senator Stephanie Pitcher was probably the most direct. And, the context of this is probably important because over the last couple of years, the Utah Supreme Court and the lower courts, but especially the Utah Supreme Court, have issued some pretty stark defeats to the legislative leadership in the Republican Party. We know we've talked about redistricting on this show a lot. They were responsible for overturning the legislature's boundaries there. There was an abortion ruling that they tried to ban all abortions in the state, and the court said, they put that bill on hold. So there's been all of these defeats where the Utah Supreme Court has issued these setbacks to the Republican majority. And so when you talk to Senator Stephanie Pitcher, she says, this is clearly an attempt to make the court more conservative, interfere with their judicial independence and get the rulings that they want. And it's kind of interesting because all of these justices were appointed by a Republican governor, whether it's Governor Herbert or Governor Cox, and all of them were confirmed by a Republican Senate. But there's been so much outrage. I mean, we talked about during the last special session that we had, there was a resolution that was passed condemning the Utah Supreme Court for its rulings and condemning Judge Diana Gibson and the redistricting ruling in particular. So, you know, there is this real consternation between the courts generally and the Utah Supreme Court specifically. And so that's why people think that this is clearly an attempt to pack the court. Now, when Joe Biden was president, Democrats wanted Biden to add two justices to the Supreme Court to shift the political balance there. And Senator Mike Lee in particular wrote an entire book about how that would destroy the independence of the judiciary, make a mockery of all of its rulings, et cetera. And so, you know, I guess it kind of depends how you see this is where you stand on the political spectrum.
By the way, Senator Lee weighed in on this in Utah.
Yeah, well, he weighed in on it in at the federal level. He weighed on
right.
It.
Yeah, so I'm wondering if he has the same view about Utah's.
He has not weighed in on this yet. No, I think it's still a little early in the game.
Yeah, Governor Cox said, "Hey, we're a bigger state. We need more justices." Former Associate Chief Justice John Pierce just retired. It was replaced. He disagrees.
Yeah, I thought this was really interesting. You know, again, justices don't usually speak out on these, but as a recent retiree, we were able to talk to him, and it was the first time he's spoken to this issue. And he said that if you're looking to make the court more efficient, it's completely the wrong answer to expand the court. And this is kind of a logical thing to think, right? If they have five, you need to get three justices to sign on to your opinion to have a majority. If you have seven, then you need four justices, and that means you're bringing more people into the editing process, making recommendations, more drafts of opinions, etc. But the bigger thing is, in his mind, is they don't. He says there isn't a backlog. They're getting through all of the cases that are briefed and ready for them to be heard. He says the problem is further down, where there's not the resources on the indigent criminal appellate level. Where, you know, for these attorneys to get these cases ready to go, and it takes up to a year for them to get them briefed and ready to be heard and argued. And then there's also a backlog at the appellate court level. So, you know, so if something goes from the district court to the appellate court before the Supreme Court, and you have these, you know, choke points at each of those steps, it's going to take a long time for cases to get through. And he said that is the issue and what needs to be done about it, is devoting more resources to the district court level and the appellate court level, which, by the way, is what the courts have been asking for several years and not really getting much of.
Does it look like the legislative branch will supply that, or is it just going to be, do we think, two more justices on the Supreme Court and two more at the appellate level?
So the two appellate court judges are in the governor's budget, and I anticipate that if they do expand the Supreme Court, they'll expand to the appeals court as well. And at the district court level, there's been some talk of restructuring the district courts. Senator Brady Brammer has been kind of floating this idea of consolidating different districts. But in terms of the resources that they might get along with that, that kind of remains to be seen. Obviously, the legislature controls the budget. Last year, there were several requests from the Judicial Council that didn't get much consideration, partly, again, because of this conflict that's been going on between the courts and the legislature.
I want to treat just one more thing in this story. You go on to provide some of the background that you just did at the beginning of this conversation. But you mentioned an event, a panel. I'm not remembering this correctly,
right,
probably from the Bar Association, right?
Yeah, the Utah State Bar, in an attempt to kind of smooth things over with the legislature, I think, had a panel where they brought in House Speaker Schultz and Senate President Stuart Adams, and just kind of walked through some of their views on the role of the judiciary, why they think the judiciary has been getting it wrong. You know, and Speaker Schultz, you know, they said that it's up to the legislature, he says, is a check on the judiciary. And so they have things that they can do to be a check on the judiciary. And this is one of the prerogatives that they have in his mind. So he was a supporter of this last session, is still a supporter of it this session. And so, you know, there's got a lot of political power behind this proposal to expand the court. It's going to be interesting to see. It's hard to see, I guess, how this isn't going to happen in the upcoming session.
Oh, that panel, this jumped out at me because it's part and parcel of what we're seeing nationally. The rhetoric sometimes, in most views, would go too far. Judge Gibson, the judge in the redistricting case, has received violent threats from members of the public. Senate President Stuart Adams condemned that. He said, we can't go that far.
Yeah, I mean, he said that they also get threats. Senator Adams said that they also get threats like that if they think it goes too far. It's inappropriate. But at the same time, the legislature is continuing to sort of ramp up its criticism of the judges. Like I said, this resolution to condemn the judiciary is kind of a remarkable step. There was talk of impeaching Judge Gibson. So, they're not threatening violence against her, certainly, to be clear. And they've unanimously said that they condemn threats of violence like that. But they do ramp up the rhetoric on occasion. And this tension between the judiciary and the legislature right now is at a pretty fevered pitch.
Let's talk a little bit before we end this segment about redistricting. So the Republican Party of Utah has they're on an initiative drive trying to gather signatures to get an initiative on the ballot in 2026, so about a year from now. What would that initiative, if passed, what would that do?
It basically just repeals the Better Boundaries Initiative the voters passed in 2018. That repeals the Independent Redistricting Commission and the prohibition on gerrymandering. So it would give the legislature the ability to gerrymander, essentially, and not have to take input from an independent commission. As we've talked about before, these initiatives are pretty tough to get on the ballot. They need to get 140, almost 141,000 valid signatures, which usually means you've got to gather about 20% more than that just to be safe. And they've got to get them in 26 of the state's 29 Senate districts. So it's a big hurdle. They've been submitting signatures for validation. Right now, I just checked it this morning. They're just under 27,000. So they've got a long ways to go. They've got until February 14th to get these turned in and verified. Well, to get them turned in, they wouldn't be verified until mid-March. So they've got some time to do it. And the chair of the Republican Party, Rob Axon, says that he thinks that there's support there for this repeal, and thinks they're going to get it on the ballot.
So it would be pretty interesting if that does get certified, right? You'd be 2026, you'd be voting again, I guess, for Congress people under the map currently in place, but then you'd be voting for a different map, essentially.
It's pretty interesting, and the reason they're doing this is because they said this the Supreme Court said previously that when the legislature gutted Proposition 4, that Better Boundaries Initiative, that violated the voters' constitutional right to the initiative. So they're saying, well, okay, this initiative can trump that initiative, and then we can repeal it that way. And so it wouldn't impact, again, you're right, that it wouldn't impact the 2026 map, but could impact the maps in 2028, 2030, 32, et cetera. So
I want to talk just a little bit, a couple of minutes, about this story. Some voters say they were tricked into signing petitions to repeal Utah's anti-gerrymandering law. So this initiative, of course, you need signatures. There are signature gatherers out there. Some people are reporting back that some of those signature gatherers are being deceitful.
This was kind of funny because this first came on my radar, to be honest, when my son was approached outside the DMV and asked if he wanted to sign. And I said, what did they tell you? And he said, well, they said this is just letting people decide the boundaries, which then I started talking to a handful of other folks who had similar experiences. One of the women I talked to up in Park City said that she was going to the Smiths, and she was walking in, and the guy said, do you want to sign this petition to give people a voice in the boundaries? And she said, well, I like the map that Judge Gibson put in place. And he said, oh, no, this is to support Judge Gibson. This is to support her map. And that's patently not what this is. She ended up signing it, is having to go through the process of submitting a form to her county clerk now to have it taken off. There was a University of Utah student who was, said that they were the the signature gatherer just said they were just trying to get information on registered voters so that he wouldn't tell her if it was a petition or not. And so she kind of gave in to some peer pressure. I think her friend signed it, so she signed it, and then later found out that that's not what it was. And so now the lieutenant governor's office, I asked them like if there's any enforcement mechanism for this or any, supervision, et cetera. And they did make a valid point that it says right on the petition that this is to repeal the Independent Redistricting Commission. So people need to, I guess, read a little more carefully what they're signing before they sign it. But and Rob Axon, again, the chair of the Republican Party, I asked him about it, and he said, well, there might be isolated incidents of when you have hundreds of signature gatherers out there collecting signatures, there might be isolated incidents where somebody misspeaks, but there's not, he said, an intentional sort of widespread effort to deceive people. He thinks that this initiative would stand and it stands on its own, and they don't need to do that.
So again, if you've experienced this and you want to remove your name from the petition, I guess county clerk's place to go.
The county clerk's is a place to go. There's a little bit that you do have to sign a form. It has to be a physical form. It can't be done online. So you're either going to have to go in there, download it offline, and sign it and send it in, or drop it off. It can be done. I talked to the Salt Lake County clerk. This was a couple weeks ago when I talked to her. It was early in the process, but she said they've been hearing reports of this, and they have the form available for people that want to remove their signature. It's not easy, but it's something that can be done if people feel like they've been tricked into this.
We'll just mention this one. Former Congressman Rob Bishop poised to return to the Utah House. So just 30 seconds on this, Robert. 1970s was when he first went to the House, I think, right?
He was elected basically straight out of college to this spot in the Utah House. He went on to become speaker. He served 16 years in this Utah House before he went to Congress. Now, Representative Matt Gwin, who is from far west, he's had a family crisis. His daughter was hit by a box truck when she was in college, and he's stepping down from the legislature in March. So he has asked Rob to run for that spot. Rob, again, has kind of been out of politics. He ran for as a lieutenant governor candidate in 2020, but he says he's eager to return to the body where his career started and finish his career there. Yeah, he's it's going to be 51, 52 years after he first joined the House. He's coming back to sort of put a bow on his political service.
One little tidbit, I can't resist this. I think I got this right. He proposed to his wife in the House chamber, I guess, those many years ago.
He says it's played an important part in his life. He proposed to his wife in the gallery above the chamber, and he served that term as speaker, and he said he's always loved serving in the Utah House.
All right. A lot of stories there. Check those out at sltrib.com. We've been talking with Salt Lake Tribune politics reporter Robert Gerke. Robert, thank you so much.
Yep. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you. Following a break, we're going to talk about this headline. How many Utahns have been arrested by ICE under President Trump's second term? Here's the data. We're talking with West Side Communities reporter Jose Davila IV. Following this break, you're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. We turn next to Salt Lake Tribune West Side Communities reporter Jose Davila IV. Jose, thank you.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Well, this is a very interesting story. Here's the headline. How many Utahns have been arrested by ICE under President Trump's second term? Here's the data. First of all, Jose, what were some of the questions you wanted to answer? Of course, this is in the context of, the national crackdown on illegal immigration in President Trump's second term. I guess you wanted the Utah data.
Yeah, I thought that, readers really need to know how big this effort, this crackdown, was really in this second term of President Donald Trump. We have been reporting on immigration a lot this year. On impacts to businesses and individual stories of arrests and detentions, but we didn't have a real big view on just how many people had been picked up by ICE, had been arrested or had been deported, who were from Utah or picked up in Utah. So that was the question we really wanted to answer, was to really give readers a good view into how big this crackdown had become here.
Now, the numbers definitely have increased this year, right, under changing from Biden to Trump. Give some sense of the numbers, I guess, this year versus last year.
Yeah, so for the arrest data is relatively stark. And this data, the arrest data is only up to date as of mid-October. But last year, ahead of Trump's second term, ICE made 1,128 arrests in Utah. This year, more than 3,000 people have been arrested by ICE in Utah. So that is a big jump since President Donald Trump returned to office. The deportation numbers are also a stark, basically in the 15 months leading up to the inauguration, the federal government deported 850 people. Then this year, since Inauguration Day, 975 people have been arrested. Now that data, the deportation data, is only up to date as of July 28th. So it's possible that there's been even more deportations as well.
I guess we mentioned data, should mention Megan Banta was with you on this story. Mm-hmm. So another key question, the Trump administration says that they are concentrating on the worst of the worst. They're concentrating on people with serious criminal histories. What was the data show us in Utah?
Yeah, so there are... Oh, sorry, you cut out there for a second, Tom.
I think we're back, yeah.
What was your question?
Oh, the question is, the Trump administration says they're concentrating on people with serious criminal histories. What I think you looked at that, at least in the data, with the people they're rounding up in Utah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so just about half of those arrested by ICE in Utah, just barely half, 55%, have criminal convictions. Among those deported, 59% had criminal histories, although some others had pending criminal charges. So it is obviously the main pillar, the main talking point for the Trump administration, and as well on the Trump campaign, was, hey, we want to remove criminals and gang members, from the U.S. In Utah, there's still obviously a big group of people who that isn't true for.
I was interested, this jumped out at me. One man you talked to several people for the story. You want to get into that a little bit. He said he was offered $1,000 several times to give up his case and just go.
Yeah, this is a policy that the Trump administration has started to really push since they came to power, which is they want to, they want to make deportations easier, right? They want to make deportations go as fast as they can, as part of this effort to really crack down on immigration to the United States. And so these $1,000 offers seem to be, being made to folks at all steps when they are interacting with ICE and even other Department of Homeland Security agencies as well. So yeah, I mean, he basically told me, this is Marco Antonio Mancilla, he told me that he had something to fight for. Like his dad is a legal permanent resident, as is another family member. He feels safe here. He's been here since 2006. And so he said, I'm not giving up this fight. I want to use my due process rights, which is what he did. He's still here now. His immigration case is still pending. But he was not swayed, put it that way.
There was a key ruling by a federal judge, I guess somewhat recently, you talked about here, that that those who, I guess, overstayed their visas, those who've been in the country for quite a while, should have a reasonable expectation to a bond hearing, at least. Tell me about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the Trump administration, via a Board of Immigration Appeals case, since about the summertime, has started a policy that basically says, if you have ever entered the country illegally, you have to be detained, no matter what, no matter how long you've been in the United States, no matter what sort of community links you have in the United States, no matter who your family is, you have to be detained. And so the three men, two of the three men that I talked to that ended up in the story, they basically challenged, they were detained by ICE, but they challenged their detentions via a wrongful detention lawsuit against the federal government, basically alleging that the federal government, by following this new policy, is ignoring the Immigration and Naturalization Act. Which differentiates between people who have been detained right after crossing the border and people who have been detained after, you know, years living in the United States. And so those people that have just been picked up crossing the border, they go to mandatory detention. That has been federal government's policy for a long time. But folks who are in the country, have built community links, have a job, whatever the case may be, those people usually do not go to detention unless they have some sort of, you know, criminal case.
Yes, go ahead.
So they challenge their detention. So they challenge their detention.
Let's see, you're cutting up
a
bit. Hey,
Tom, I can't hear you.
Yeah, I think we're cutting up a little bit there. Again, let's try that again.
Okay. These couple of guys, both Mancilla and Gildardo Escobar, who I spoke to, both of them were, you know, released after winning these wrongful detention lawsuits. Basically, judges found that that the federal government was not following the law set by Congress via this new policy. So therefore, they have been able to get out.
One of the men you spoke to had been deported to El Salvador. I think he's there at this point.
Yes, that's correct. So I also talked with Noe Escamilla, who had lived in Utah for more than 20 years. He was deported on September 24th. He is still in El Salvador. I spoke to him via his lawyer, Kendall Moriarty, who's based here. He alleges he was wrongfully deported and has now sued in federal court asking the government to return him to the U.S., where his family still lives. He has at least two U.S. citizen children. His youngest son is 4 and lives with nonverbal autism and a rare genetic disorder. And so he's just trying to get back to his life. Basically, what happened is his lawyer, Moriarty, filed a motion for the government to reopen his immigration case when he was detained by ICE in Utah. That should have creates an automatic hold on his case. That means the government can't deport him until they hash out the immigration case that he has. And that didn't happen. The federal government deported him before they could even talk about reopening his immigration case. So he's in a tough spot. He's He's not really making much money. He's not able to send money back to his family here in Utah. He's driving Uber and making $10 a day, he told me.
Yeah. You talked to some, I guess, wives, domestic partners. So how is this affecting families?
Yeah, so Tammy Staples is the longtime domestic partner of Hildardo Escobar, who we talked about a little bit earlier. They call each other husband and wife. She had a really tough time taking care of their kids while Hildardo was in ICE detention for more than 3 months. And in fact, they had to move out of where they were living because they couldn't make payments. They had to give up their car, and now they're living with family. So it's hard for the people left behind to carry on to make the financial sacrifices and make ends meet while these men who are often primary earners are detained or in one case deported.
Then the story you quote, Mr. Mancilla, he says we live in fear here in this country. I guess that is heightened this year versus last year.
Yeah, you know, like I said before, he was adamant that he would keep fighting his case. All these men were, he's also knows that it's an uphill battle. And this is definitely a more pervasive feeling, this feeling of fear, this feeling of anxiety, this year, just because of increased, immigration enforcement here in Utah.
Anything else you'd like to say about this story?
No, I mean, one thing that to keep an eye on, we know that Utah has attracted a lot of Venezuelans in the last 5 years or so, as that country has become less and less stable. Just some stark numbers, like more than 85% of the arrests of Venezuelans in Utah have happened after Trump returned to the Oval Office. Deportations are creeping up as well. For the first time since the recent destabilization of Venezuela. So something to keep an eye on because we know that's a big community here.
All right, thanks for telling us about this. Let's just do about a minute on this story, Legacy Highway. It's going to get a lane, additional lane in each direction. I didn't know this until I read your story, Jose. There was an agreement. Obviously, this was considered environmentally sensitive when they built this highway, that they couldn't build an extra lanes, but that expired in 2020, so now they can, I guess.
Yep. The original agreement that was the result of a lawsuit by some citizen groups basically limited speeds on Legacy to 55 miles an hour. There were no trucks allowed on Legacy, like big box trucks, and there were only two lanes in each direction. That agreement expired on New Year's Day 2020. Now, you know, you can drive 65 and there are big rigs. And now this is kind of, you know, one more step away from, you know, this road that was different, was supposed to be different than other big highways in Utah. And so it's going to be a big change.
Now, UDOT itself, just one more thing, that UDOT itself says, well, their studies show that air pollution probably go up, noise pollution probably go up, but they say this is better than the alternative.
Yeah, specifically on, specifically on traffic, right? That's what they're trying to solve here. But also on air pollution, because they maintain, UDOT maintains in this environmental study that they did for this project, that if cars move faster instead of sitting in traffic and idling, therefore, the air quality would be better in 2050 with the third lane than without the third lane. Now, whether that's better air quality now versus now, well, they didn't mention that, but they are comparing the no action to the action in 2050, and that's what they came to.
All right, we'll keep an eye on this. We've been talking with Salt Lake Tribune Westside Communities reporter Jose Davila IV. Jose, thank you so much.
Thanks, Tom.
And coming up following a break, we'll be talking about this headline. This Utah charter school is under review after it gave little oversight to its bookkeeper, allowing years of payroll errors. We'll be talking with education reporter Carmen Nesbitt. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Here's the headline we're going to talk about in this segment. Utah Charter School is under review after it gave little oversight to its bookkeeper, allowing years of payroll errors. We bring in Salt Lake Tribune education reporter Carmen Nesbitt. Carmen, thanks for joining us.
Of course.
Thank you. So which charter school are we talking about here?
So this is regarding Tippenagos Academy in Linden and charter schools. I think a lot of people get confused. Charter schools are public schools, right? So they're subject to the same laws and expectations, and they are funded by public dollars, just like, you know, any other traditional school would be. The difference is they sort of self-govern, right? Rather than having a school district, being part of a district where that sort of leadership comes down, it's self-governing in a way, but still subject to Utah laws and all of that. And so basically, what happened with this was there was a complaint given to the state auditors regarding payroll errors, and specifically about employees at the school's HSA and retirement accounts going back years. And so this state audit looked into the finances of Tippenagos Academy between, I think, 2018 through 2025. And what they essentially found were years of errors where at times employees, you know, HSA or retirement contributions would be from their own paychecks, right, were over or under, or the school match was over and or under. Some employees benefited from these errors. Other employees potentially lost thousands. So the school is currently in the process of, you know, writing these errors. And part of that was allowed because, according to auditors, the bookkeeper at the time operated with little to no, and that's a quote in the audit itself, little to no oversight. And when auditors went in and started asking school staff, school leadership questions, they weren't able to really answer those questions as to what happened. So yeah, that's the gist of this. Hmm.
The bookkeeper is no longer there, I understand. There is some question about what the school should have known or investigated before they hired this person, because they had a previous criminal, record.
Yeah, so there's a lot of pieces and layers to this one. So this former bookkeeper, prior to being hired at the school, I don't know exactly how long she worked at the school. Transparent Utah shows records dating back to at least 2014. So we know she was with the school since 2014 at least. However, prior to being hired, she pleaded guilty to theft by deception and possession of a forged writing device, which are both felonies under Utah law, but they were, kind of lowered to misdemeanors as part of a plea deal. And her former employer had accused her of stealing more than $100,000 in 2004. And so while the audit does not mention this, it's, you know, a quick look in court records shows this. Mm-hmm. And so the question is, did they look into her background? Did they, you know, even ask any questions before hiring her? These are answers the school did not respond to me. I did ask those questions. They didn't answer. And, you know, the audit, though, and to be clear, the audit did not find any evidence of criminal activity or this person stealing. They kind of chalked it up to generally poor accounting practices.
Which, you know, sometimes happens, and you try to prevent that, but with some internal controls, right? And that was missing, I guess, in this case.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. And that was kind of the point of the audit, or one of the main points repeated in this audit was there was no oversight. There was no backup bookkeeper. There was no one checking this person's work, essentially, which allowed these errors to occur.
So I learned this from your story, Carmen. I guess I should have known this. There is a Utah State Charter School Board. I guess the charter schools are under this school board. What are they saying about this?
So I interviewed kind of one of the people in charge there at the State Charter Board, and they work. So not only do they provide oversight of charter schools, they also authorize charter schools. And so what that means is a group of people come and they say, "Hey, we have this idea for a charter school. Will you authorize us?" And they have to go through a whole process, right? Before they can, you know, become a charter school and start accepting public money and kids and stuff. And so Timpanogos Academy, and there are some other charter authorizers in the state. I can't tell you off the top of my head what they are, but there are some universities who do authorize charter schools. But the state, Utah State Charter Board is the largest in the state. They were the authorizer of Timpanogos Academy. And so, you know, in talking to Marie Stephenson, who is the interim executive director at the charter or state charter board, she said they were aware of the audit and they are looking into Timpanogos. They're doing their own sort of research and review, is what they call it, to see, you know, what else is going on. And one of the things I asked Stephenson was, you know, were you aware? Was the State Charter Board aware? They had essentially hired, you know, an ex-convict to manage their finances. And, you know, her response was, "Well, we don't oversee those decisions. Those decisions are made at a local level," which is pretty, you know, that's standard practice. And so I said, "Well, do you know if they did a background check on this individual?" And she said, "Hopefully, through their research and review, they're gonna answer those questions about what happened and why was there little oversight. Did the school know? And if they knew, why did they let her operate, you know, without any oversight at all?" So those questions are hopefully to be answered.
All right. Yeah, I'm sure you'll be keeping track of that as answers come in. We're talking with Carmen Nesbitt, education reporter, Salt Lake Tribune. I want to do 2 or 3 minutes on this fascinating story, Carmen, that you had recently. Here's the headline: Had to get creative with little snow. This longtime Utah dog sledding family is offering warmer, muddier adventures. So I guess I could go up right now, and I guess at this point, it's not on a sled pulled by these dogs; it'd be on an ATV pulled by these dogs.
This was a really fun one. I typically report on K-12, but this was a nice little feature. We went up to oh, I'm gonna mispronounce this. Pioa?
Yeah, I think it's Pioa, yeah.
Pioa. Where this family runs sort of a sledding operation slash ranch slash tourism business there, and they've been doing this for a long time. And basically, with climate change and the warmer winters and the delayed snowfalls, what they've been doing is kind of hooking up dogs to ATVs versus a sled for their tours. And to be clear, the dogs do not pull the ATVs while they're not operating. The ATVs are running, but it just kind of gives them the exercise that they need. Also gives tourists an experience, and it is what they do to train the dogs in the off season. So they just, I don't know, they kind of took that training and turned it into a way for tourists to still experience the dogs when there's no snow.
I guess the real purpose for their operation is they rescue dogs, right? And then they provide them a
That's
good
right.
home. Yeah. And these are athletes, you could call them, right? These are not you wouldn't want these particular dogs in your house. They'd probably go crazy if they're sedentary.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. So Rancho Luna Lobos, which I don't think I've said the name of the ranch yet, but yeah, it's Rancho Luna Lobos, run by Fernando and Dana Ramirez, and it is primarily a rescue operation. They do dog sledding. They're, you know, Fernando is a medaled, awarded dog sledder, musher, and so. That started for him as a young child, and the rule his mom gave him was, you can dog sled, but you're not going to buy trained dogs to do this. You are going to train them yourself. And so that kind of carried over into the rescue they operate now. And I got to go and I got to meet these dogs, and they are to like you said, Tom, they are not your typical dog. Like, yes, they love the belly scratches and the head scratches and stuff like that, but they are so high energy. They are not gonna, you know, sit in your house. They need a job. They need a purpose. For, you know, using Fernando's words, they need a purpose. And dog sledding for many of the rescues gives them that purpose.
We'll have to leave it there for time. Urge people to go to sltrib.com and read the whole story. Fascinating story about these dogs and that operation. Karma, thank you so much.
Yeah, of course, Tom.
Well, it's time for our underplayed stories of the week. We'll start with Robert Gerke. What's your underplayed story, Robert?
Yeah, I would direct people to a video that the Tribune produced about excuse me, my dogs are now speaking of dogs that can't behave. Sorry. A video the Tribune produced with the eyewitness accounts of the Charlie Kirk shooting from our reporters who were there, Emily Anderson Stern, Trevor Christensen, Trent Nelson. They did a really interesting job, and it's a sort of a boots on the ground look at that shooting down at UVU a few months ago.
All right, sltrib.com for that interesting video. Jose Davila, what's your underplayed story?
I really liked Tony Semerod's story about the Greek Orthodox cathedral that went live today. Basically, the Holy Trinity, which is the Greek Orthodox cathedral in downtown Salt Lake City, right, kitty corner to Pioneer Park, just got a big bunch of money to redo and reinforce some damage and clean up some damage from the 2020 earthquake. So some good news there, and it's a cool building. The photos are awesome.
All right, sltrib.com for that one as well. Carmen Nesbitt, what's your underplayed story?
Well, I don't know if this is underplayed, but any chance I get to talk about my alma mater, I will. I went to the University of Michigan, and as we all know by now, Kyle Whittingham is going to be head coach there. And there was a really great piece from Gordon Monson, 20 things Michigan football fans need to know about Kyle Whittingham. And go blue.
All right, yeah, now that's another Utah-Michigan connection, I guess, besides you, and there's probably others. So check that one out at sltrib.com as well. Well, on Behind the Headlines, this first one of the new year, we've been talking with Salt Lake Tribune politics reporter Robert Gerke. Robert, thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. Happy 2026.
Happy 2026. West Side Communities reporter Jose Davila IV has been with us. Jose, thank you.
Thanks, Tom. Sorry about those technical difficulties.
Oh, no worries. Happy New Year. And education reporter Carmen Nesbitt's been with us. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And thanks, everyone, for listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Hope you'll be with me again next time.